The collection of Psalms, all 150 of them, come from what were originally many smaller collections, doubtless from many hands and written in many different contexts. We can assume, I think, then, that the final editors took great thought and great care in putting the first psalm in its place at the head of the collection. Blessed is the one, and not so the wicked. Now, this psalm seems to be telling us that there are two kinds of people in the world: those whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and those referred to as the wicked, the sinners, the scoffers. Now, we're a very tough audience, I think, for such a reading. It seems to speak to us of us and them. And as Christians, I think we have read enough of the Apostle Paul, who wrote, "I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do." And we instinctively know what he means. We regularly pray, "Forgive us our trespasses and deliver us from evil." And there's a real sense when we do that it's a rescue from ourselves that we need. So we don't like to think about us and them. But today we're reading this old poem again, and we're considering its wisdom. It's a wisdom psalm, as a matter of fact. There really is a difference, writes the commentator Lance Pate, between a life instructed in and oriented toward God's will and one that attempts to find its own way in the world. We are not invited by the psalm to somehow celebrate in triumph our status as righteous insiders to God's will, but to clarify our options. Now, I need to say a word at the outset about the phrase, "the law of the Lord." The Hebrew word is Torah. The Torah is made up of narratives, stories, and commandments. In fact, there's lots more stories than there are commandments. It was Israel's conviction, as we can see from the Hebrew scriptures, that a series of events that took place in her history was decisive for God's relationship with the human race. In these events, in these happenings in history, in the Exodus from Egypt, in the giving of the law, in the crossing of the Jordan, in the building of the temple, God was speaking. And Israel constantly returned to these events, plumbing these stories, remembering them, meditating on them, and in them they saw the essential shape of life that God intended for them to live. They learned from this sequence of history that life is a journey where God goes before as the guide and the example, that God is always provident, always accompanying them as a guide and instructor. And the truth is that he himself is the route that they are to take. And the adequate response that they saw they ought to offer, in the adequate response for them was wonder, gratitude, and obedience. The Psalms are full of it. Wonder at what God has done, gratitude that God had chosen them and revealed himself to them, and then obedience should come naturally. The commandments are rooted in what is known of God through these events. For example, Leviticus 19 says this, 1-4. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Say to all the congregation of the people of Israel, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God.'" The commandments call to Israel. They call us to be holy as God is holy. Therefore, as Stanley Hauerwas writes, like God, we are called to be what we are, to do what we do. For example, to leave part of our fields unharvested for the poor, because God is that kind of God. Blessed is the one who delights in the Torah of the Lord, who ponders the stories and the instructions. For that one will be as a tree, planted by streams of water, rooted and grounded and fruitful. The tree image suggests that such a life prospers, not as a kind of reward for being good, but is the organic result of obedience to God's creative, life-giving will. Likewise, the one who goes his or her own way, with no thought to God's will, they receive the inevitable consequences of going against the grain of the world that God has made. Now we can imagine what it was like for a distinct community that tried to live in gratitude and obedience to Yahweh, to God, in the Assyrian, in the Babylonian, and in the Persian periods, when the cultural and the political powers would have liked nothing better than to abolish its distinctiveness. From the prophets of the time, we can see that the greatest threat, in fact, to the future of the community, to their identity as a nation, was that the world of Jewishness was just too costly and too demanding for some of its neighbors, for some of its members. The easy option was to go along with the dominant culture, and eventually it eroded the Jewishness of many. And those who were faithful, who remained faithful, they went deep into their memories and so sustained their hope. As Lamentations says, written in that period, "Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him." The writer was probably living in Babylon when he wrote that, waiting for the deliverance that he knew would come, because God was the God who always remained faithful to his promise. But what of the young who did not, after a while, remember the ancient glories of Israel? Surely they were prime candidates for assimilation. Some commentators think that the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, was actually aimed at them in particular, at the young. And this song is thought to be from that very same period of the exile. As part of the yearly celebration of Passover, to this very day, the children are invited to ask three questions about the significance of the ritual. And in reply, they hear this, the Exodus story. "We were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand." We heard them at the Seder Supper this year. They are to understand that it's God's story and it's their story too. And its aim is to recruit the young into wonder, issuing in gratitude and obedience to the Torah. The preaching, the teaching, and the study of Torah is in order, Walter Brueggemann says, to set one's heart differently, to trust and fear differently, to align oneself with an alternative account of the world. Now, for centuries, the Western world has been hostile to the Jewish faith. And now, we have a little taste of what it feels like. It grows increasingly hostile to the claims of Christian faith as well. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, wrote the Jews in exile? I think that we are having to ask ourselves some of the same questions. Excuse me. Oh. But the threat is not so much from foreign gods as the Israelites faced. Although there are many idols that threaten to lure us away, we are formed by what we desire. Big headline on the back page of one section of the Globe and Mail yesterday. We are formed by what we desire. That's the line that's written across the ad for John Irving's new novel. That's also the word of Psalm 1. We are formed by what we desire. And our culture's highest desire, highest virtue, is being independent, being self-reliant, autonomous. And that word actually means a law unto oneself. Autonomy is a position from which it is absolutely impossible to maintain a distinct communal identity, as Christ intended the church to be, as God called and enabled the Jews to be. The privatization of meaning makes real, deep, organic unity almost impossible. This week I had a conversation with a woman who told me that she was an Anglican with what sounded to me a little bit like a love-hate relationship with her denomination. She said there were things now that she believed and things she had discarded, and what she was left with answered her questions and made her comfortable. And she seemed to be inviting me to say something. So I said, well, I didn't think that our faith was supposed to make us comfortable. And that what was wrong with her faith was precisely the fact that it was hers. She designed it. She decided on the boundaries. How can we be called beyond and above ourselves, I asked her, if we are the judge of what is believable and thus of what is possible? Sorry. There is no tolerance for wonder when the world can be managed or prescribed. There's no appreciation for gratitude when the world can be taken in self-sufficiency. And there is certainly no readiness for obedience when the world has become an arena for autonomy. The previous week, I went to my daughter's to pick up something, and Hannah, who my 12-year-old granddaughter, was having her after-school snack. I gave her a hug and I asked her how her day had gone. She said, oh, Grandma, you would not believe it. And she proceeded to tell me about the session that day at Muchmore School that made the front page of the Citizen this week. She was one of the 53 girls who attended an anti-bullying workshop to help students learn to focus on the tools they have inside them, recognize their inner voice. I quote from the article. The problem was that some of the inner voices were very bleak. Some of the inner voices were even self-destructive. As Hannah told me, when they were encouraged to write down their secrets and they were read aloud, which they had not expected, a chaos of tears was the result, eventually ending, of course, in letters to parents, etc. We surely cannot always be guided by what's inside us. And at 12, in an age when information, good and bad, is coming at them from all directions, it is risky indeed to say to someone, be guided by your own voice. Nowadays, I think we're very fond of using the term centered. We speak of looking for a center. This psalm for today is responding to this search. But it says that we make a mistake if we think that we will find that center in our own selves. This does not mean that we shouldn't examine ourselves. This does not mean that we shouldn't plumb the depths of our souls and do a lot of self-searching. But it's telling us that at the end of all our striving and all our searching and all our journeying, to discover that the center for the self lies within God will satisfy that same self much more than anything else. And just as the tree draws life from the water, so we are born, we are created, we are designed to draw our life ultimately from God. I think that we are a blessed church. We are blessed with growing numbers of children and young people. A few weeks ago, 6 confirmands stood here and stated their beliefs in their own words. It was thrilling. Last week, 5 families brought their babies for baptism. Will they grow to be like trees planted by streams of water, their roots deep in the soil of faith? Will their hearts be set differently? Will they trust and fear differently? Will they be aligned with an alternative account of the world? Of course, I don't know the answer, nor do you. It really does come down to the choice that this psalm sets before us. But I do know this. We are among those whom Jesus prayed for in the gospel reading, the ones to whom he gave the words that he said lead to life. The words that he said would sanctify us, would make us holy, if we would live them. For centuries, our Jewish friends have been telling their children and telling each other, we were Pharaoh's slaves, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Let us tell each other that we are loved and forgiven, accepted, that life is so much more than this life, that creation has a meaning and a purpose, that God entered our world in our Lord and lived our human life even to the point of dying, and therefore he knows our human condition intimately. To have these truths as the basis of one's life makes a tremendous difference. With these truths at the center of our lives, we can trust our inner voice. To possess these truths as a Christian can sometimes even save us from the evil one, who takes many forms: anxiety and fear, depression, anger, resentment, hopelessness, meaninglessness, all the demons that afflict human lives, robbing us of peace and joy. So may you be like trees planted by the stream, bearing fruit, which David Burrell says is more like becoming something than doing something. Yet the results are not only tangible, but they're nourishing for others. Bearing fruit is to let ourselves become a gift for others, for each other, and especially for our children. A gift for others as he did and as he is. Amen.